This is an ABC podcast.
Italy remains on lockdown as officials and healthcare workers struggle to contain the coronavirus pandemic.
The situation is so bad, one specialist told local media they are overwhelmed and are having to choose who to treat. And in some cases, older patients may not get the same level of care.
Your health system, no matter how good, how efficient, how modern it is, sooner or later will collapse because the number of patients is too high.
Italy is a cautionary tale. It shows us that if COVID-19 spreads too quickly, health systems will buckle. And when they do, it won't be possible to help everyone. I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre. And today on The Signal, the ugly maths behind who we save and why.
Okay, so if we've done this right, then you won't be able to tell, but this is episode one with us working from home. Like, as we speak, I'm sitting on my bed under the blanket.
I too am in my room. I'm sorry if you can hear my housemates. They are all working from home as well.
And to be clear, it's not because we're sick or that anyone in the team is. It's all part of the plan to flatten the curve, which is a phrase you've probably heard a lot over the last week or so.
Yeah, so flattening the curve is the whole idea that inevitably a certain number of people are going to catch COVID-19, but if we at least slow down the rate of infection, the outbreak will be spread out over a longer period of time and hospitals will be able to cope better. And one of the best examples of what happens if you don't is Italy.
So many hospitals are nearly collapsing, and the forecast for the next 10 to 15 days is even worse.
The fatality rate has reached 6%, that is almost twice what was shown in China at the beginning of the epidemic.
Before you can realize what's happening, you are like overwhelmed by the mass of patients. So everyone must understand that if you are not very careful in controlling the spread of the disease, this disease will overwhelm your system, no matter how efficient, good, modern it is.
Yeah, health systems buckling basically when you've got too many people knocking at the door, well, being wheeled to the door, for the hospital to cope with it. And you've got to start making serious triaging decisions about who actually gets to use those resources. So, for example, in Italy, they're having to use triage decision-making, whereby some people are not given the level of care that they would get in any other circumstance.
That's Tony Blakely, a professor of epidemiology at the University of Melbourne, who's becoming a kind of regular on the pod. And he told us that when something like this happens, there's actually a series of difficult decisions that hospitals have to make.
You've got to work out whether you're going to call back all staff, call back retired staff, get your staffing capacity up. You need to decide whether you're going to dip into your reserve stocks of surgical masks and all the paraphernalia that's needed in an ICU. You then need to work out what you're going to do front of house as far as triaging patients coming in, who you're going to send home, who you're going to admit, who you're going to send straight to ICU. There's a lot going on, but at the very pointy end of it are decisions about, well, who's going to get ICU or intensive care and who isn't. When the resource is very limited there. And there are a number of decision-making frameworks for that, but the most common one uses a utilitarian framework whereby you try as best you can, everybody's doing this on the fly, you try as best as you can to pick those people who are going to get the most benefit from the resources from ICU care, which obviously means there's another side to that coin where some people have been looked at and said, don't think we can help you too much. We'll just put you in a ward somewhere. We'll give you supportive care. Whether or not you make it or not, we can't guarantee.
Let's talk a little bit about the decision-making process, what the inputs are into that. So it's kind of ugly to think about, but for anyone who isn't a philosophy major, let's talk a little bit about utilitarianism play. It's kind of if you left a mathematician in charge of well-being, right? It's like the idea of maximum happiness for maximum number of people, but it can be very brutal and outcomes-driven when you plug it into a health system and lead us down some dark pathways, like considering how much it's worth spending to save someone.
That's one way it manifests, and it's pretty brutal at some level, but it is a good way to at least in principle deal with a situation like this. So what is utilitarianism? Utilitarianism is the maximum possible benefit you can get for the most people you can get it for. Now, how would that play out? It plays out in somehow working out of all the people in front of you that might need care, who's going to get the maximum benefit from that care? Now, that's actually very hard to do. We don't actually have patients walking in with a microchip in them whereby it says, if you treat me, I've got a 10% chance of, well, let's say an 80% chance to survive. If you don't treat me, it's 10%. That information is not presented to us. We can kind of work those things out after the event and with research in the times when we're not in an epidemic. So we have to default. We have to default to rules of thumb. And those rules of thumb are that younger people are more likely to benefit more, that people without serious comorbidities are likely to benefit more. It's not bulletproof, but it works reasonably well. And that's the type of approach that is used in that situation. Now, that's just thinking about the patient, the person, the female or male in front of you, what benefit they're going to get. Now, you can actually go out in layers here because you might have somebody in front of you who's got three kids under the age of five. Now, society gets a utilitarian benefit from that person surviving because they have a carer in place. So you can keep going out like this. And you can even go all the way out to, well, should the Prime Minister get extra care because they're so important that they're leading the show? So it has various flavours and flow-on effects, but the principle itself, the core principle itself, is getting the maximum possible benefit you can for the resources you have in front of you.
Now, when doctors make those decisions, sometimes in minutes if it's an emergency, age isn't the only factor that they're considering. They might also think about what other illnesses someone might have, which is way more complex terrain.
If you've got somebody who's not severely sick, let's deal with somebody who's moderately sick. Now, the person who's moderately sick but otherwise is entirely healthy, they may well pull through without much help. But the person who's moderately sick has also got diabetes and had a diagnosis of breast cancer 3 years ago, so let's imagine something like that, but they're reasonably well now, they could stand to benefit quite a bit because they're on the edge. They're tinkering, they're sort of possibly about to fall over that precipice. These are, as you can see from the way I'm outlining it, these are multifactorial issues to consider, and there's a lot to weigh up in here. When you're really seriously unwell, though, you know, somebody who's coming in, they're already having to be ventilated, they're unconscious, they're clearly extremely unwell. At that point, the person who is otherwise fit and healthy, apart from what's happening right now, have got a much better chance of pulling through and benefiting from the hospital resources than somebody who's already got chronic lung disease, say.
Yeah, I want to talk a bit more about comorbidity because it's a complicated one, because if we're just talking about the length of life, then it seems like simple mathematics. But then there are people who might have a chronic illness who
yes.
might be likely to live for a very long time, but, you know, their quality of life is less. Does that plug in?
Well, I'll talk from my own experience here. So I'm clinically trained. I've done my time in emergency departments, but I now do research and I have the luxury of telling these things up. And your question, to answer your question, the answer is yes. So for example, somebody who's got quite poor quality of life, say they've lost 30% of their quality of life because they've got chronic shortness of breath, they can't get to the mailbox because of respiratory disease, then when we're doing our aggregate models, when we're considering the benefit to society, we do factor that in. And we assume for that person, if they've lost 30% of their quality of life, that each extra year they live is only worth 0.7 or 70% of an otherwise healthy person. Now, that is utilitarianism playing out quite brutally in the spreadsheet.
For me, there are parts of the calculus that are maybe a little shocking at first blush, but you understand them. You know, for example, an 80-year-old versus a 40-year-old. There is a certain amount of life left to be lived. Where I start to struggle, though, is the questions about quality of life
yep.
and the value that's assigned
yep.
to quality of life.
Yep.
That seems to be an entirely more controversial proposition.
That is really controversial, and you are very correct to bring it up. So before, when we were talking, I said, well, you know, I can just work out the maths. I can say this person's lost 30% of their quality of life. Therefore, each extra year of life they live is going to be worth 0.7, not 1.0. And I can do that all in my spreadsheets. However, that conflicts with the equity idea. This person was unlucky enough to get multiple sclerosis, say. Do we penalize them for that? It's an extra consideration. There's also a lot of research done on people with a chronic condition like diabetes or lung disease or angina, whatever it is. And as a society, we say, oh yeah, that's worth about 10% of loss of quality of life. But once you've got the condition yourself, you accommodate to it. You actually go through this process where you change the way you live. And each extra day you live is not worth 0.7, it's actually worth 0.85 or whatever it is. So this process is known to happen.
I think some people would argue as well that, you know, in some cases, life becomes worth more to you at that point. You value your life more greatly and use it to a fuller effect because of, you know, what you've learned.
Yep. And if I may get a little spreadsheety geeky, we call that the discount rate. So, for example, if somebody's only got 3 years left to live, it's going to be very precious to them. And, you know, it's close in time. It's about to happen. It's next year. You know you've got this holiday booked. It's far more important to you.
The kind of naked brutality of the utilitarian approach, it seems to me that it is really starkly in contrast with the conventional wisdom that's marketed by politicians, at least in developed nations, that life is priceless,
yeah.
Access to care is equal. It just couldn't be further away in a lot of ways. So I guess my question is, how do you think people might respond to the ideas you're talking about if they understood that this was what was informing the distribution of resources in health systems?
All right, so let's just pull out of the pandemic phase and speak a little bit more generally about health systems. The reality, it's not even brutal, it's just reality, is that we are prioritising all the time. So, you know, let's consider a screening program. We're considering whether or not, say, to start screening smokers to see if they've got a lung cancer by using CT screening. Now, that's probably going to cost somewhere like $70,000, $100,000, somewhere around that mark, per life year saved, per healthy life year saved. Now, for most society, that's getting a bit pricey, and so we don't do it. And what we do is we're trying to get the researchers to go back and find cheaper ways of delivering that type of benefit. Now, something like colorectal cancer screening, bowel cancer, that's actually a really good investment. It's probably only $10,000 per healthy life year saved. So we invest in that as a society and we let rip. Now, because it's prevention, it doesn't result in a patient in front of you in front of the paper, you know, headlines about somebody denied treatment, but it's happening. There are people out there whose lives have been saved because of a colorectal cancer screening program. He'll never know about it, but we know that there's thousands of people in Australia who are going to have their lives saved by this going forward. So that type of arithmetic, this utilitarian approach, this approach of working out how much you spend per healthy life year gain, it's happening in the system and it's hardwired in. So for example, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee that does the decision making on what drugs will be subsidised or not, it uses this framework explicitly, transparently and with strong support. You know, over the last 20 years, these types of things have been done in in-depth Sunday newspapers, and society is pretty accepting of that.
Okay, so this system for deciding who to save, it's part of the health system all the time, not just during a pandemic. A pandemic does show it up, though.
Are we likely to see this kind of calculus exposed more in Australia as well, in a way that it has been in Italy?
Well, that all depends on how good we are at flattening the curve. So I think everybody's now familiar with this concept of flattening the curve, except there's going to be heaps of cases, but we don't all want them happening the next month. Let's make them happen in the next 6 months. And as Boris Johnson calls it, let's squash the sombrero, make it last longer. As long as we can do that, then the decision-making is not going to be as in our face because we won't be making as much of those prioritisation decisions. If Australia is successful at flattening the curve or squashing the sombrero, then we won't see it as much. However, if it really takes off, we will be exposed to these hard decisions we will see situations where gymnasiums are used not just for mild illness, for putting people in there for quarantine, but that, you know, we could see wards opened up in hospitals where they don't have the ventilator and ICU, where very sick people are simply because we've exhausted the capacity within. I don't wish that upon any country, but it is possible it could happen. We have a huge degree of uncertainty about exactly how this is going to play out. Flipping it though, all societies, Australia included, have some pretty big levers that we can pull to try and stop us getting to that horrible situation. So for example, closing borders, closing schools, social isolation, asking people to work at home. There are many levers that we can use, but they do come at a cost. Impingement on people's civil liberties, economic impacts, share market chaos. These are the consequences of this type of decision making.
Tony, you seem to have a lot of faith in people's capacity for, you know, a reasonable response to what you see as the best framework for decision making. But I mean, if Australia does find itself in that position where that kind of thinking is exposed in the way you describe, when it's someone's mum who isn't getting treatment or mm-hmm. their diabetic son or, you know, what have you, do you think people mm-hmm. will be as forgiving of that rationale in that instance?
Maybe in the fullness of time, but in that type of situation, we all have our emotional, and I'm not using the word emotional to belittle it, it's part of being a human being. We have the emotional reaction to those types of situations, and there will be angst, there will be people very upset, and there will be situations in the benefit of the hindsight we'll say, oh, we didn't quite get the decision making right, but we do need to make the decisions as we go. It's inevitable there will be disagreement about how some of these decisions are making, be it on the macro levers that we're just talking about, you know, closing schools, down to the meso level, the middle level of, you know, which hospitals take on patients and which ones keep doing surgery for other people with priorities that aren't due to pandemic, and then down at the really pointy micro end of decisions with patients right in front of you.
That's it for our first episode of The Signal at Home. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't, and you can get in touch with me or Stocky on Twitter if you'd like. And we'll catch you tomorrow.
See you then.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.